What do you hear when you listen? What do you hear when you listen in this space? The children? Your stomach growling? People weeping on the inside? And what do you hear when you listen to the world? A coming storm? The sound of owls? People weeping on the outside? And do you listen differently when you try to listen with God? Do you tap into a different frequency? Do sounds previously drowned out move to the forefront? When I try to listen with God to the world, I experience the E.B. White dilemma. E.B. White, the 20th century American writer who wrote Charlotte's Web, among other books, is purported to have said, "I arise in the morning torn between a desire to save the world and a desire to savor the world. This makes it hard to plan the day." Save the world or savor the world. That's a predicament I find myself in when listening with God. And it summarizes the conundrum of my faith. It's also the tug of war I experience when reading the biblical text. On the one hand, there's God's response in Genesis, when after surveying the mountains and the seas, the fruits and the vegetables, the animals and the peoples, God says, "It is good. It is very good." In fact, God says, "I think I'll spend a whole day just savoring this goodness." And on the other hand, there's the verse in Luke where Jesus, the incarnation of God, nearing the end of his ministry and approaching the center of human activity and power, looks over Jerusalem and begins to weep. "If you," he cries, "even you, had only recognized the things that make for peace." And in despair and in love, he trudges on to save the world. To savor and to save. This is what I hear when I listen to the world with God. We've been working with this theme of listening with God for 4 weeks, and appropriately so. The call to listen to God, to Jesus, to creation, is sprinkled throughout the Bible. And followers of Jesus have had over 2,000 years now to attune their ears to what God is listening to. So you'd think by now we'd all be dialed into the same frequency. But what different Christians today say they are hearing couldn't be more discordant. We've talked some about this in the second hour class on progressive Christianity that I've led for the past few months. How progressive Christianity listens in a markedly different way than does the dominant Christianity in the United States, which is comfortably in tune with empire, capitalism, and a certain brand of politics. And it's because the prominent association now between Christianity and that politically conservative mindset has gotten so strong over the last 30 years that author Anne Rice was moved to type her famous Facebook post of 2010, which said in part, "Today I quit being a Christian. I'm out. I remain committed to Christ as always, but not to being Christian or to being part of Christianity. In the name of Christ, I refuse to be anti-gay. I refuse to be anti-feminist. I refuse to be anti-artificial birth control. I refuse to be anti-Democrat. I refuse to be anti-secular humanism. I refuse to be anti-science. I refuse to be anti-life. In the name of Christ, I quit Christianity and being Christian. Amen." Now, I understand that sentiment and am sympathetic, but I seek to reclaim rather than reject Christianity. And that is in part because over the last 30 years, I've fallen in love with the Christian story as told in the Bible, which I think contains a powerful rebuttal to today's right-wing civil religion, as well as a challenging tutorial for a different way of listening to the world. Let me spell out a bit of what I mean. All the synoptic gospels have near their beginning a story of Jesus intentionally and intensely listening with God. They tell how at the dawn of his ministry, Jesus goes on a 40-day vision quest into the wilderness. And while there, he struggles with all the false messages and teachings he was hearing. We know these as the devil's three temptations. And they amount to a confrontation between Jesus and the false messages of the religious authorities of his time, and also with the false messages of the political authorities of his time, and thirdly, with the false messages of the purveyors of wealth and commerce of his time. And friends, these are exactly the same voices that tempt us in our time. And those voices were telling him, hey, listen to us, not the foolish ramblings of that crazy locust-eating prophet. This is how the world works. You work hard, you get for yourself as much resources, power, and self-protection as you can acquire, and you don't make a fuss about those who are too lazy or too weak to keep up. I'm telling you, you've got to get what you can for yourself. There's a lot of bread to be made from these stones, if you know what I mean. Yet the text tells us that that was not the only voice speaking in the wilderness. The other was more still, smaller, only perceptible in a prayerful quiet far from the distractions of empire. But Jesus heard it. And after 40 days of desert living, he strode home into Nazareth and into the temple to tell his friends and neighbors what he had heard. We learn of this in Luke 4, where Jesus says something like this. You know what I heard when I listened to God? I heard that God has good news for the poor, the oppressed, those afraid, and those who are lost. And his friends say, okay, but is there anything for us? Jesus says, oh, didn't you hear me? I specifically mentioned the lost. And his friends were not amused. And things got even more strained when Jesus added, and you know, this good news is as much for the outsiders as it is for you. In fact, it's even for your enemies. So, who is with me in building this new kingdom? The response, Luke tells us, was swift. They all rise up in rage and drag Jesus up the hill so they could throw him off the cliff. But in the end, Jesus passes through the midst of them and goes on his way. So the Gospels start with this countercultural listening, which doesn't get a favorable hearing in Jesus' hometown. And after that, the struggle to listen the way God listens and to see the way that God sees takes center stage. Mark's gospel particularly focuses on this inability to hear and see by describing a series of healing stories where Jesus heals people of their blindness and deafness. And as we discussed in the young adult Sunday school class, these stories can be read for their literal message, that Jesus literally cured some blind and deaf people. But a progressive reading, and I think an even more powerful reading, is one that considers also the symbolic, the political, and the narrative function of these stories. Mark tells these stories not because he wants to demonstrate that Jesus has supernatural healing powers, a point modernists get hung up on, but Mark tells these stories because symbolically they tell us so much more than that. They tell us about social boundaries and class barriers, about conflict and campaigns of inclusion, about the disciples' incomprehension and the sacred hope that we may be among those healed of our deafness and blindness. So take, for example, the story we heard this morning, where Jesus has traveled into Gentile territory and has brought a deaf and dumb man, a man seemingly incapable of listening to God for all kinds of reasons, most obviously his deafness. And what does Jesus do? The text tells us, he puts his fingers into his ears, and he spat, and he touched his tongue. Then looking up to heaven, he sighed and said, be opened. And the man was healed. Now that's a little weird, right? What are we to make of that? Don't we usually dismiss such stories as an embarrassment of antiquity, where Jesus spits and pokes, says some incantation, does some wizardry, and voila, you're cured? Well, if that's what we think, We are more deaf and blind than these characters in the Bible. Here's part of what I think is going on in the symbolically rich story. The chapter in Mark containing this story begins with a confrontation with the Pharisees. And as you know, the Pharisees are the guardians of social orthodoxy. They determine what and who is clean and unclean. They maintain gender, ethnic, and class divisions by stressing fidelity to their traditions. And they confront Jesus in Mark 7, verse 5, saying, "Why don't your disciples live according to tradition?" Now, when you're listening with God, and most certainly Jesus was, what do you hear in that question? Sure, they are defending tradition, but that's not inherently problematic. We need traditions and the social structures that they create. But when tradition is cited to insulate the architecture of entitlement and privilege enjoyed by a dominant culture, well, then it makes Jesus spitting mad. So it's in that context that we get this story of Jesus healing the deaf Gentile. And he does so by violating the traditional purity codes, which exist to keep the impure and the unworthy out. In Jesus' hands, saliva, a substance considered as pollutive as excrement, becomes the agent of transformation and healing. And as a result, the deaf can hear, the blind can see, and the voiceless are given voice. This is the saving work of Jesus, the work to which we are called. And the irony revealed in this story only increases in the very next chapter of Mark. There, the disciples, who are often stand-ins for us, the readers, there the disciples are talking with Jesus and exposing how little they've understood these signs and wonders. You can practically hear Jesus' exasperation when he says, "Do you still not understand? Do you have eyes and fail to see? Do you have ears and fail to hear?" Jesus, it turns out, can heal the Gentile deaf person and make that person hear, but not his own disciples. No wonder Jesus ends up weeping. I arise in the morning, torn between a desire to save the world and a desire to savor the world. This makes it hard to plan the day. Jesus, the Bible also tells us, periodically sought to take a break from the crowds, to go to the mountains or the wilderness for some rest, relaxation, and listening with God. Coincidentally, that's actually part of my sabbatical plan this summer as well. Now, I'm not saying I'm just like Jesus or anything, but there is this different kind of listening that happens in the wilderness, one that opens us up to the vastness, the beauty, the healing, and if this word hasn't become too trite, the awesomeness of God's steadfastness and love. Immersing oneself in natural settings, forests, rivers, deserts, can often invoke awe in us. And when we experience awe, it changes how we listen. I've been thinking about awe ever since I read a delightful article last spring written by two psychology professors. The article started with this curious fact about goosebumps, that physiological reaction in which the muscles surrounding hair follicles contract. It turns out that we humans, along with many non-human mammals, get goosebumps when we face a threat and when we're scared. But humans are unique in that we can also get goosebumps when we experience awe, that often positive feeling of being in the presence of something vast that transcends our understanding of the world. Awe is this intriguing mental state that researchers for some time have argued is the ultimate collective emotion, for it motivates people to do things that enhance the greater good through various activities that can give us goosebumps, which in addition to wilderness treks can include music, dance, religious rituals. We shift our focus from our narrow self-interest to the interests of the group. And this, I think, is theologically profound and fascinating. And the empirical research is growing to support the claim that awe helps bind us to others, motivating us to act in collaborative ways that enable strong, cohesive communities. Or to put that in Christian terms, awe opens us up to listening, loving, and caring for our neighbor. For example, in one study, more than 1,500 individuals across the United States were asked a series of questions to assess how much awe, among other emotions, they experienced on a regular basis. And in an ostensibly unrelated part of the study, each person was given 10 raffle tickets that would be entered in his or her name for a cash prize drawing. And each person was told that the tickets were his or hers to keep. But if he or she wanted to, they could share a portion of them with another unidentified individual who had not received any tickets. Researchers found that participants who reported experiencing more awe in their lives, who felt more regular wonder and beauty in the world around them, they were more generous to the stranger. Specifically, in this study, they gave 40% more of their tickets away than did participants who were awe-deprived. Other research was conducted on the campus of the University of California, Berkeley, which has a spectacular grove of Tasmanian blue gum eucalyptus trees, some with heights exceeding 200 feet, a potent source of everyday awe for anybody who walks by. Now, some participants were taken there and told to look up for 1 minute into the trees. Others were told to look at a nondescript facade of a nearby science building. And then a minor accident occurred, actually a planned part of the experiment, where a person stumbled and dropped a handful of pens. And what they found was that participants who had spent the minute looking up at the trees, not long, but long enough to be filled with awe, they picked up more pens to help the other person. Fascinating, right? In still other studies, the question of why awe arises altruism was being explored. And the answer is that awe imbues people with this different sense of themselves, one that is smaller, more humble, part of something larger. Even brief experiences of awe or wonder, such as being amid tall, beautiful trees, or perhaps singing in four-part harmony, can lead people to feel less narcissistic and entitled, and more attuned to the common humanity people share with one another. The authors of this research write, "In the great balancing act of our social lives, between the gratification of self-interest and a concern for others, fleeting experiences of awe redefine the self in terms of the collective and orient our actions towards the needs of those around us." And then they make this further observation. You could make the case that our culture today is awe-deprived. Adults spend more and more time working and less time outdoors or going camping or attending live music, the theater, museums, art galleries. Also, art and music programs for children in schools are being dismantled in lieu of programs better suited to standardized testing. Time outdoors for novel, unbounded exploration are sacrificed for resume-building activities. And the researchers conclude, "We believe that awe deprivation has had a hand in the broad societal shift that has been widely observed for the past 50 years. People have become more individualistic, more self-focused, more materialistic, and less connected to others. To reverse this trend, people need to experience more everyday awe, to actively seek out that which gives them goosebumps." I rise in the morning, torn between a desire to save the world and a desire to savor the world. While this may make it hard to plan the day, it is, I believe, the dual focus of those who listen with God. Spiritual wholeness requires that we engage in both. And we do this in part by coming together each Sunday morning. to bring healing to our spiritual deafness, to expand and celebrate our experiences of spirit-filled awe, and to encourage each other to join God's sacred work of saving and savoring the world. May it be so.